Bottle Canal.
This is Mark Roberts. I am taking an oral history on Mr. Morris Futrell. This is March 25th, 2010. All right. Let's start with just a little bit about where you're from.
We're from Western Tennessee and Western Kentucky. When my mother and father married, they moved to St. Louis. And I went into the Marine Corps in 1940, September 1940. Went to San Diego for the training. We began our training as an amphibious professional immediately. But our country was so ill-prepared that we actually built platforms on the beach. And the top platform was about the same level as a deck of a transport that we would come down the landing nets on. So we practiced landing, coming down the nets, and then making the landing with our equipment. But it was rather interesting the way that I, there's my official record as far as the war is concerned in the Pacific. I will just touch briefly on the landings that we made. The first one was on Bougainville. The next one was on Guam. The third and last one was on Okinawa. Then we returned to Guam, and we heard that there was an unusual weapon developed and had been used against the Japanese homeland. And we didn't know until the next day exactly what it was, you know, that it was an atom bomb, and who knew what an atom bomb was. Well, we thought we were going home, but rather than all of the 6th Division going home, those that were regular Marines stayed, and those that had volunteered but were not regular, they were sent home. And we soon learned that we were going to Qingdao, China. That's a large Chinese seaport. It's up in northern China. And all that information we were given initially was that there were 500,000 Japanese troops and civilians there, and that they were going to officially have a surrender ceremony to the 6th Division. But we soon learned that the problem was more complex than that. The Japanese had landed in China in 1937. And this was 1945, late in 1945. In addition to the battle with the Japanese, they were also involved in their own civil war. The communists and the nationalists were fighting. In fact, in Qingdao, there were, sometimes we could actually hear the artillery being fired in a battle between the communists and the and the Nationalists. We had orders not to fire on any, either a Chinese communist or any Japanese. But the Japanese, after the surrender on the Missouri, they were quite cooperative in the surrender and our occupation of northern China. But at times, when we would go on liberty, we wouldn't know whether we were looking at a communist soldier or a nationalist soldier. Hmm. But the nationalists were trying to destroy sections of the railroad from that extended from central China to the northern China. In northern China, they had the coal fields. And they were sabotaging some of the tracks and crossings. So we had some Marines that were assigned to these guarding these coal trains. And there were a few incidents of our being involved in a gun battle. And we did lose a few Marines there. But after the surrender ceremony, those of us that had been out in the Pacific for the longest, about 3 years, we were sent home immediately. And we went into Seattle, Washington, where we stayed about a week to get reoriented. And then, since I had gone initially to San Diego, and I really liked San Diego, the Liberty, and L.A. was not very far away, and I still had my address book, by the way, after 3 years. So I wanted to stay there. It was interesting that the first Marines I met was a very close friend, and we actually had been dating two ladies that shared an apartment together in Los Angeles when we went to the Pacific. He went to the Pacific first because he was in the 2nd Division, and they made the landing on Guadalcanal. But they too stayed out for about 3 years. Their last battle was in Iwo Jima. But just to relate back to San Diego, I met him and I said, I still have their address and telephone number. I said, if they're still there, do you want to go up if they'll see us? I called them and who I was, where we had been. We haven't seen you in 3 years. We just got back and we'd like to come up and see you. They immediately agreed. So we went to L.A. and had our first weekend on Liberty in that area with girls that we had been with 3 years ago. Hmm. It was almost just like a weekend had passed, you know. But for some reason, rather than keeping me at San Diego, I was transferred to a guard company on the smallest Navy base in the world. There was a naval proving ground where they tested different types of weapons at Dahlgren, Virginia, which was a small town. Like I said, we were south of Washington, D.C., about 50 miles. And we provided the security for this naval proving ground. It had one company of Marines. But I liked Dahlgren, Virginia, and this proving ground very much. It was like being on a resort, you know, with tennis courts and the weightlifting room and the golf course. And it was just really excellent. I had 6 months to do when I arrived there, but after 3 months, I was actually sent to Quantico, Virginia. And I found myself in an infantry company And we had the very important mission of retaking a Japanese position that they had reconstructed beneath a hill. Up on top of the hill were bleachers, and they would invite the congressmen and the senators and other high officials in the government to have come and have a day or 2 days where they would be wined and dined, and then they would occupy these bleachers while we ran through taking this Japanese position again. I stayed there until I was ready to be discharged, and I was discharged exactly 6 years after I had gone in, September the 6th, 1946. After the training at San Diego, we went to Camp Elliott, which was a new base out in the boondocks about 30 miles from San Diego. And it was there that our training intensified a great deal. And I was in the artillery unit, the 3rd Battalion, 12th Marines with the 3rd Division. We trained there for several months. Then we were the first unit to go into Camp Pendleton. And the 3rd Marine Division was being formed at that time. And our regimental commander was Lemuel Shepard. And Pendleton was used again as it increased the training to more direct combat. We had knife fighting and bayonet fighting and judo wrestling. And then we went to boarded ship there. Of course, we didn't know where we were going, but our first stop was at New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand. And we continued to train there. We were there about 3 months. The young men, New Zealand young men, were all in Africa fighting against Rommel in the desert. So the ladies there were quite pleased to see us, and we were very happy to be there with them. Then we departed on our first South Pacific island. We went to Guadalcanal. Guadalcanal had been secured at this time, but the we were still being bombed, and there was still some activity from the sea. Since it was secure, we didn't have any concern about being under attack from anything. The first night, we had about 1,200 Marines in the regiment, and we were planning to set our tents up in a huge coconut palm area. Very few men, if any, dug a foxhole that night. I dug one about 6 inches deep. To our astonishment, the Japanese bombers came in and were bombing Henderson Field and decided to annoy us with bombing our area. And we were actually welcomed to Guadalcanal by Tokyo Rose, the 3rd Marine Division. And she reminded us what our girls were doing back home. When the bomb started falling, we found out what it was to experience fear. When they laid that first one down, you know, you'd hear that was loud. The next one not quite as loud. The next one less as loud. Then you knew that the next one was going to be very close to you. But that night, they had the bombers in the searchlight, the fence searchlight. And one of our, we call them night fighters, went up from Henderson Field, and we could see in the light, he was firing directly into the belly of these bombers. And 3 of them came down. Mm. And we went out the next day and located the 3 the three bombers that had been shot down. We continued to train at Guadalcanal, and we went aboard ship, learned that we were going to make our landing on Bougainville. Bougainville is the largest island in the Solomons. It's northern, probably 400 miles from Guadalcanal. And on November the 1st, 1943, we made the landing on Guadalcanal. I have, my record has identifies every ship that we embarked on, and then the ship that we were on when we made the landing, the name of the ship when we returned to Guadalcanal, then identified the name of the ship when we made the second landing, and gave the dates of the landing, and also the dates that the island was secured, and we would return to either Guadalcanal later to Guam. I won't spend too much time on talking about the battles on Bougainville and our battle on Guam and Okinawa, because many histories have been written about that. But just briefly, Bougainville developed into a more serious landing than we thought. We had opposition from the Japanese on the beach. In addition, we were strafed and our transports came under attack. I was on I should know it right now. I'll give you the name of the ship later. I was in the second wave, and we were part of a forward observer team, and my responsibility with four or five men was for the communication from the forward observer back to the guns, you know, to orient the setting for the weapons and commands to bring the firing more on the target. So I usually made the landing right with either the first or the second wave. In the second wave, we just got on the beach when the strafing, the Zeros came down and strafed us. And I looked up and our transports were pulling out. I didn't know that they did that when they were apt to come under attack. But I said to my friend, we were back in the coconut tree, I said, I do believe they're going to leave us on here. Wish they didn't. This Bougainville, the terrain there was extremely difficult. Sometimes we would be wading in water up to our knees, swampy, heavy overgrowth, hot, many different insects. In fact, the overgrowth was so heavy sometimes that we could actually hear the dogfights but not see the planes at all. There was an active volcano on Bougainville, which we saw when we came in to make our landing, Mount Begonia. During the day, the smoke was evident. At night, it had a red glow around it. One morning, we'd been on the island, I guess, about a week, that earth began undulating, just like an ocean wave. And we knew that there was an earthquake. Momentarily, we thought that the island was going to drop into the ocean. But it was just a very short duration. But it did interrupt our artillery fire. But Bougainville, years later, came into my experience again. And we'll talk about that in a little while. But I acquired a Japanese soldier's flag. You know, when they left home, their friends or family would write their names on them with best wishes. I brought two of those with me. The one that I picked up on Bougainville, I have. And I returned that to the Japanese veterans in Tokyo in 19, it's been about 5 years ago. But we'll talk about that a little more than we did with the other activities. I don't know how much time we have. Is that
about an hour for the initial, and then they determine if they'd like to come back?
Oh, I see. Well, we'll just move through this. But I will spend more time on my meeting. I was a lone Marine meeting at the annual meeting of the Japanese veterans that we had fought on Guadalcanal and Bougainville. One of them was a captain of a destroyer. He was involved in the Battle of Midway. But that was an astounding meeting. I haven't written anything about that yet, but I do have the material, and I do plan to do it and send it to the Marine History Group at Quantico. We returned from Bougainville right after the first of the year. I won't identify the unit that relieved us, but I think this story should be told. We learned that we were going to be relieved by another unit. And the morning that the colonel of the regiment that was to relieve us, I was at regimental headquarters that morning. And I fortunately was there, otherwise I never would have known about the comments that were made.
Look at this, brass knuckles of the
knuckles. The colonel relieving us said to our colonel, after a few introductory remarks, "Where are your alternate positions?" Well, that kind of startled our colonel. He got quiet, and everyone that was in there said, "How is the colonel going to respond to this?" He said, "Well, we have no alternate positions. My men live and die in these holes right here." And I said, "Colonel, let's talk about living, not dying," to myself. Anyway, we had to stay on the island about a week reinforcing and constructing alternate positions before we could return to Guam. Then, of course, we began training for our next landing. We did some practice landings, down in the New Hebrides. One of the beaches that we landed on, about 50 yards in, had a big sign with a big bulletin board. And on it, he said, whoever wrote it said, "The cost of equipment being stolen in the Pacific is enormous. For example, the 3rd Marine Division has, we believe, has stolen all of these different hundreds of items." And here we were reading about ourselves. We didn't know we were thieves. But we were, because sometimes their equipment was much better than we had, or we didn't have it at all. But it was just a humorous event that did happen. We returned to Guadalcanal. In 2 days, we were told we're going aboard ship on the third day. So the third day, we fill out all of our equipment and lined up, ready to get in the landing boats and go out on a transport. After about 30 minutes, the announcement came that we are not making that landing. Well, that didn't make any of us really unhappy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we later learned that the island that we were to land on, each time that the Navy battleships bombarded it, or planes strafed it and bombed it, the opposition would increase. It was building up. And apparently this was one island that could be hopped over. We didn't make the landing on that one. But our next landing was on Guam. That was in 1944. We were to land on Bougainville. Land on Guam shortly after the Marines made their landing on Saipan. But we encountered so much opposition on Saipan that they delayed our landing for about 3-4 weeks. And rather than making the landing on Guam immediately after that, they sent us to Kwajalein and Eniwetok in the Marshall Islands so we could get off and exercise and swim and regain our strength. And then we made the landing on Guam. The landing on Guam was the first American territory that was taken in World War II. It had fallen to the Japanese shortly after Pearl Harbor. I believe there were only maybe about 200 Marines on Guam whenever they were overrun. Mm. The a personal experience. My friend that I mentioned to you before, Al Friels, that I had met at San Diego. Well, the 2nd Division, they had made the landing on Saipan. Then after Saipan was secured, they moved into Guam to support our unit there. We had, in our landing, the Japanese had pulled back down. In fact, we kind of chased them for several weeks. It might have been the 3rd week, but we stopped one morning and we decided that we would just take a break there and get all of our equipment cleaned up and get our clothes washed. And during the morning, there would be an occasional mortar fire would come in, either beyond us or in front of us. It wasn't enough to get our attention until about 11 o'clock when the sky fell on us with mortars and with artillery. They hit part of our ammunition. They knocked out one of our guns, and trucks were moving out with men that were moving, providing them with plasma. And I had picked up those pictures that I showed you of the American Marines and the Japanese soldiers sometime just prior to this bombarding from the Japanese. And I had placed my pack and my equipment, communication equipment, in a building. And we had been outside washing our clothes, and our equipment was inside this building, along with my personal pictures. Well, some of the fire hit the building, and I said, I'm not going to let them get my picture. So I ran back in, grabbed my pack and my equipment, and those, the shingles and so forth were rattling. I was glad to get out of that building, and I said, I'll never do that again, even if I lose my pictures. But I did get them. Saipan was a very critical operation because it provided an island where our B-17s could fly from there to Japan and return. I want to get back to Al Friels just a moment. I learned where they were, and I left our gun position and went to find him. And I found him, and we had a brief renewal. And they had just run over a depot of Japanese sake and wine, and so we had quite a celebration. We went up in the hills. We heard that there were pigs up there. I aimed at a pig and missed him, and that pig ran in front of me. I took my rifle like a pistol and fired and knocked the pig down. So we took the pig back and had a We made a barbecue sauce out of ketchup and Japanese wine. Then we returned back to Guadalcanal at that time. And our next landing was on Okinawa, which was a very difficult landing. And we had many casualties. I have read a casualty list of from 20,000 to 22,000 Marines and sailors. The Navy lost more men on the Okinawa landing and the future support that they gave to us to the kamikaze fighter planes. And they, it was more than just an occasional attack. It was a frequent attack.
Hmm.
And our destroyers, of course, were the main outlying force. And they took a heavy brunt of the attacks. Then they would come in and attack whatever supply ships that were in the area or any other target that they... But they only had, you know, their bomb and the pilot whose purpose was to dive his plane onto a ship. And we lost heavily there due to that. I learned later that our division commander Lemio Shepherd, who later became the commandant, he set a goal of attempting to persuade more Japanese soldiers to surrender, a greater effort than had ever been made. We had interpreters that would go to a cave and try to persuade them to come out. And 3,000 of them did actually surrender. But many of them, there were instances whenever, if there was a group of 50 in a cave, maybe 20 to 25 or 15 would come out. When they would leave the cave, they would be shot down by those that were still in the cave. But there were some unusual incidents that occurred whenever a Japanese would want to surrender to one of our Marines. There was a case, one instance, that kind of illustrates their outlook upon giving their life. This was a Japanese officer that stepped forward to a Marine and was handing him his watch, a beautiful watch. Then he took a grenade to his chest and destroyed himself. I later met I attended a 6th Marine Division, 3 or 4 years ago. And I met one of our Marines who was known as a tunnel rat. He would actually go into those caves and search for Japanese that were in there. Now that's rather astonishing.
Yeah.
And at the reunion banquet, he was at our table along with a Marine officer, a major, and his wife was the 6th Division historian. So I got to talk with this Marine, and he had given the story to the lady historian. And briefly, it was, they were going toward the end of the island on Okinawa. And of course, hundreds of them jumped off there. When he was looking at the terrain, and it was quite heavily in grass, except one part was moving. And he knew then that was a tunnel, and that the air coming out was moving that, making that grass move. Well, that was his signal, you know. He went in, and to his astonishment, he found the leading general who was the commander of all Japanese forces on Okinawa, who had died. He killed himself. And around him was his staff. And some of them had their throats cut, because apparently their attempt wasn't successful, so others would kill them.
Hmm.
Well, he went back and reported that, and he was asked not to give any information about it, because they wanted to, recover any maps or any records at all that would be helpful. But that's a rather unusual story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is.
I had a lot of fun that night. I had a friend with me that wanted, he would ask the waitress for an apron. He wanted to take an apron at every reunion back to his girlfriend. He had been turned down, so a waitress came to our table and I asked if she would get an apron for him, which she agreed to do. When he received his apron, I said, well, I'd like to have one also. So she brought an apron to me. And I stood up. I have a picture of this. I stood up trying to get it on. And I couldn't tie it. And I said to the Marine Major, would you mind tying this apron for me? And he got up and tied it. And his wife said, I bet that's the first time you had ever had a major tie an apron on you. Well, that's just an illustration, of the fun that we had. After Okinawa, I do want to mention this battle area and refer to one man, Medal of Honor receiver, that I was acquainted with. There was a hill. It looked like just a knob. We called it the Sugarloaf Hill. But it was the highest elevation on that part of the island. And of course the Japanese were using that to bring their fire down upon us. And I understand that we actually took that hill 7 times. This was a vicious battle. And we kept it either on the 7th or the 8th attempt. The fire was so heavy that for the Marines to recover their dead, they had a trap door in the floor of the tank, and they would drive the tank out and bring that Marine up through that door to bring him back behind our lines.
Hmm.
I was at a reunion at Elizabethtown. I came in a little late, and I walked down the bar, and there was a man sitting there. His hair was as gray as mine. So I introduced myself and sat down, and he gave me his name. And we talked for a while, briefly. And then he said that he had to go to the head. And when he got up, he said, Morris, I am so full of holes. When I walk, the wind blows through me. And I had, before this comment, when I would look toward him to talk with him, he had a medal on that I had never seen. And I said, Richard, what is that you're wearing? Oh, he said, it's the Medal of Honor, just nonchalant, no fanfare.
Hmm.
Just the Medal of Honor. And his story was in our 6th Division paper, but his comment was just tremendous, Morris, when I get up and walk, the wind blows through me. He was a medic and actually went over the hill and pulled back a number of Marines. And then there was a little group and a Japanese grenade came in. He threw himself on the grenade. He was the only Marine, or as far as I know, any combat person that ever survived a grenade after he had thrown himself on it.
Hmm.
But that was Richard.
What was his last name?
I'm sorry, it's absolutely slipped my mind. I hope I've got it here in my book. My memory is, in some instances, it takes me a while to, particularly with names. But he's from Glasgow. And we had another Marine with the Medal of Honor. In fact, he was a member of the flag raising on Iwo Jima. And he lives just east of Winchester in a small community. I know his name, but I'm sorry I can't repeat it now, but he survived the battle after they raised the flags. Hmm. Well, we return to, I do want to make this comment. I want to make sure that I'm not presenting myself as a hero. I never did take a charge. I never did charge into a Japanese position, but I was close to it. Fortunately, I survived. And even though we took every type of fire that they had, I'll tell you one story that I can't verify. I can say it's true because I was there. It was on the first night of the landing on Guam. We were just off the beach and we dug in. And there were some Marines that were yelling for a corpsman. They had infiltrated our position. And I'm laying in my foxhole and I've got my rifle underneath my leg. And suddenly, over my foxhole came this bulking figure, looked like a Japanese. I'll tell you one thing, I was frightened. I have never been so frightened in all of my life. Hmm. I couldn't get my rifle up, and I yelled. And he yelled back, and this was our corpsman, going to tend to the Marines that were calling for the corpsman. But then I stayed in my foxhole, you know. And some 2 or 3 hours later, I felt a thud. It wasn't a gentle thud, it was a heavy thud. But I stayed in the hole. The next morning, I could extend myself out and touch a 16-inch naval shell. And do you know what a 16-inch naval shell looks like? It's about 6 feet. And it's huge in its diameter. We had, in our battery, we had nothing to dismantle it with, but we called for the Seabees, and they came down and did the job on it and took it back. I said, I don't want to see that one again.
This was Japanese?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I didn't really get see it as again until we, in one of our reunions, we went to a naval admiral's museum. And they had some of our landing boats there, you know, the Amtrak, the Alligator that we rode in, and the, the Alligator. And they also had the different types of naval weapons from World War II, and that 16 naval shell was there. And I put my arm around it. I asked my wife to take my picture. I do have a picture of it. The landing, one little comment about the landing on Okinawa. We came off of an LST and an Amtrak. We came, they let the bow down. We came out into the water, got about 50 yards away and hung up on a coral reef. He couldn't get off of it, tried time and again to dislodge it. So we jumped in the water, up to our shoulders, expecting the Japanese to bring fire on us. Well, that was a long 200 or 300 yard walk, but they had pulled back just as they had done on Iwo Jima. Rather than defending the beach area, they pulled back where they had prepared their defensive positions, of a lot of caves and interconnecting tunnels. And we returned to Guam, as I mentioned, and then we went to China. We had houseboys in China, And we lived, my unit, we lived in an apartment that had been occupied by the Japanese and some business that they had. We call it a compound because it had a wall around it. We understood that all of the Japanese should have gotten the word about moving out, but my friend and I, when we went up to the second level and opened the door, there was a Japanese family sitting in the center of that room having their morning breakfast. I don't know who was more surprised, whether they were or whether we were, but of course we left immediately and gave them an opportunity to get away. But I do have the pictures of the surrender. Did I bring in another? Here it goes. We'll talk a little bit about that surrender if you would like to.
Okay. That would be interesting.
Because I have some very interesting pictures. My brother was a submarine sailor during the same 6 years that I was in the Marine Corps. On the landing on Bougainville, I'm jumping around a little bit now, but these things just kind of come to my mind.
Yeah, that's fine.
On our landing on Bougainville, I knew the submarine that he was on. And we were up on the deck getting ready to go down the nets. And someone said, this naval officer that's here, he was working with the ship to shore fire, I believe. They told me that he knows where the ships of the Navy are. So I went to him. I said, my brother is on the submarine Grayling. Do you know where that is? His expression changed immediately. He said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the Grayling was recently sunk. And that was a blow to be told that my brother was gone down with the Grayling.
Yeah.
It was about 3 months later until I found out that my brother had made so many patrols, he was the only one that was left at Pearl Harbor. Mm. And he was the only survivor of that before the Grayling went down. But we'll talk a little bit about this.
Okay.
I won't go into in much detail about the ships that the subs that he was on. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I went on the internet. I knew which sub he was on, 6 different subs. And I went on the internet and I got the website on both of them, on each of them, and got the history of the war history of each one. One of them had a reunion association with a person to call. That was the last one, the Rasher. So I called this fellow, Hessel Walker, told him who I was, and he and my brother were very close friends. They were both electricians' mates. Mm. And there was one other person on that reunion that was Carl Ruff. So there were two of them that my brother was with on the last 6 runs that this submarine had made. My brother had died about 25 years ago. So I met with this group on 2 occasions, and they have what they call a relief for a regular Marine who has been off of the ship for some, off the boat for some reason. So I asked if I could be my brother's relief. So their roster includes my name as a relief for my brother. And I've met with them twice. And the stories that they have told me has been astounding. I'll stand up and find a...
Now, what is this?
Yeah. Oh, yes. This is a New Testament that was given to me about 1941. And I know it's about that time because I had a little newspaper item, and Lou Jack was a quarterback for the Chicago Bears at that time. And I used that as my bookmark. But I carried this in a tobacco pouch. You know, the men that smoked pipes had a tobacco couch. And I put this in that pouch to keep it away from the weather. But that's a Bible that I had for all of those years. And that kept me in touch with my Lord. And then I had this, I've always enjoyed literature, poetry, and novels. And this, that was a little book, 101 different poems that I carried along with my, with the Bible. And that kept me in contact with the outside world that I was so fond of. I'm now a member of the Gideons. This is a Gideon Bible. I'm now a member of the Gideons, and I meet sometimes with our Marine recruits and hand these Bibles out, you know. I think one characteristic I had, I would keep these personal items like that. And I have some postcards that I mail from boot camp at San Diego to my mother. And when she died, they were in her things, and my sisters gave them to me. Then I had one card. I was in the CCC camp before I went into the Marine Corps. I have one card that my mother had that I mailed from the first CC camp that I had gone to. And I've made all of that part of my... And I used to say that the Marines didn't make us. When we arrived, we were ready, you know. And we were. We worked outside. We lived in a barracks. We worked with each other. And speaking of just keeping incidental things, there is my boot camp rifle record. Wow. And I wish I could say that I was an expert, but I had to struggle to become a marksman. Huh. But I did make it, though. You don't see many of those. I also have my dog tags. I kept them on until I was discharged, but I've given those to my son. Let's talk about this gentleman. That is Colonel Lamar Curry. Colonel Curry was the commander of the 10th Artillery Battalion. And I met him by telephone. I was running a reunion at, I believe it was at Washington, D.C. And I called him and invited him to the reunion. He was 90 years old then. And he said that he could make a firm commitment. But at this reunion, I had arranged for every one of the men that attended it. I arranged for a Kentucky colonelcy for them. I had a friend that was in the legislature. And I told him what I wanted to do. I've got 20, 30 men coming that were in the Pacific, from Guadalcanal to Iwo Jima. Some of these guys were. And I want to get a Kentucky colonelcy for them. And I said, I also want to get one for the regimental commander. His name is Lamar Curry. And on Guadalcanal, that was the first time that Marine artillery supported Marine infantry. Well, the general and I, we became quite good friends just over the telephone, you know. And I didn't tell him that I had this. Kentucky Colonel certificate for it. But I sent it to him along with a letter. And he responded, this is a letter I wrote. Yes, this is my letter. Mm-hmm. See, I've got a couple letters here from him that are really interesting. You want to see those?
Sure.
Oh, this one is wonderful. I really prize this one. And I haven't given this material to the Historical Society yet, but I'm going to get all these things together, you know, with all the details, and send it to them. But this is really a document that would be prized. He was a general whenever he was retired as a brigadier general. I've got my check. Is that letter dated September the 28th, or is it different?
That's September 28th.
I've got two of those. You read the... This is also the 28th. Goodness, I hope I didn't bring my check. Oh, that's not it. I've got a check from it. I've had it in my... Goodness, surely I didn't bring that with me. It's not there. I guess I'm overlooking it someplace. He sent me a $2 check to cover the postage.
Oh, of his colonelcy?
Huh?
Of his colonelcy?
No, when I sent him the certificate. The colonelcy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he said, I want to take care of this expensive cost of it. And I've got it. I know I've got it. Maybe it's over here. Please, I must have my check. There it is. I prize this so much. My goodness, there it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I really prize that. Now, that's just the way he and I were getting along, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just really was...
Postage.
It's astonishing how many... of our officers that we contacted that were just, they were just a tremendous men, I'll tell you that. They were just tremendous. But Colonel Curry was the commander of the artillery unit, and that was the first time that Marine artillery supported Marine infantry was on Guadalcanal. Now, here is the, I'm not through with this yet. I want you to read that. That was written by a Army reporter who had gone up to the front on Guadalcanal, and Colonel Curry was up there meeting with the infantry commanders about any information that would be helpful for the artillery to bring proper fire on. It's tremendous, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how much I prize this. Now, before I'm finished, I'll let you take the picture. You can take my picture.
I've got a good backdrop there.
Pick up this club. What do you think about that club? Look at the one Colonel Curry has.
Ah.
This is my club. I've had this club since going in on Guadalcanal, 1942.
Hmm.
Traded can of Spam to a Navy for this club. And I didn't know, of course, when I, as soon as I saw this, I knew that he and I had the same club, you know, the same type club.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable.
It is.
And I've got a picture in here someplace. Well, I'll take it. You want to take my picture? You can just...
Well, if you sit right here, because I've got a great...
We'll just relate it to Colonel's, his club. This is a Melanesian war club. I should have it up like this.
That's good.
I have a picture in here of our group, and I had a grass skirt on with this war club. It was taken on Guadalcanal. There's one envelope I want you to look at, because it has a urgent message on it. I know it has to be here. Here it is right here. This is an urgent message to the mail carrier. He wanted to make sure I got that check. And when I would call him and talk with him, I just really enjoyed it. And he was too. He was enjoying it. You know, he was one of the boys, you know. And we're colonels. We're all colonels. But that check was just really a treasure. There's not many people that have a $2 check from a general, huh? But then, unfortunately, we all pass on, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
I called one day and was told that the general was no longer with us. He had gone on his way. I contacted a major. I've got a picture of him also. That we had had no contact with whatsoever until the reunion at Washington, D.C. He had become a physician, a pediatric physician. We did know that. And I called, but he wasn't there, but his wife was there when I called. And I explained that we were having a reunion in Washington and we would like to have she and her husband attend. She contacted him, and he called, and he said that he had not been at any reunion, but he would come to this one. Hmm. However, he too passed on before the reunion, but his wife and his children came, and it was an honor to have them there. And I gave them a picture that was taken of our battery at Camp Elliott. And he was in front with a big campaign hat and the high top leather, very dominant person, you know. And they had never seen the picture.
Mm.
But I gave it to her that the night of the banquet. And well, we got off track a little bit.
That
doesn't make any difference, though.
No, it really doesn't. You were going to talk earlier about your flag.
Yes. We're on our way. I wanted to relate that to the surrender and relate it also to the Bougainville campaign. This was my flag here, this lower one. I had that flag for 60 years. And I, occasionally, once or twice a year, there it would be, you know. And then several years ago, I decided that I wanted to return it to the Japanese veterans. And I felt that if they had a flag, something personal, and I had been killed in action, that my family would enjoy receiving it, though. I took the flag to a Japanese restaurant in Louisville, and I said, I want to talk with any Japanese waitress that speaks Japanese. I want to show her a flag that I'm trying to return. They introduced me to a lady, and I had the flag with me, and she took pictures. She laid the flag out and took pictures in quarters, and then she made one flag. To make it short, she returns to Japan, not every year, but often. And she knew about the Japanese Solomon Island veterans, told me that she knew them. And she would attempt, she said, I will contact them and let them know what you want to do. And she did, and brought me in direct contact with these Japanese veterans. It's an unusual story because it also involves, I had been a Rotary Club for years and years and with Bell. And the veteran's name was Susumu Kikamoto. Tomoko, Japanese waitress, told me that his son-in-law was an American and had come to Japan under the Rotary Foundation, you know, of exchange of students. It so happened that he liked Japan so much that he stayed, and he became very skilled with the Japanese language and became a teacher. And he fell in love with one of his students, and his student happened to be the daughter of my Bougainville veteran, Susumu Kikamoto. And that worked out beautifully, you know. But to make it short, I explained that I wanted to come. I was interested in the Japanese educational system, the museums, the gardens, the old ancient cities. They invited me to come to their annual reunion, which was at a huge Shinto shrine. And this Shinto shrine was dedicated to any Japanese that had lost his life defending the nation. They believe that these individuals return as a deity, as a god. I did my research and learned that there were 2,500,000 deities involved with this particular. This was a veterans, the one veterans shrine in all of Japan. Little did I know what I was going to be involved with, or what I was going to experience. I took the flight. They knew when I was to arrive. And Mr. Kikamoto, his daughter, and his little grandson was going to meet me at the airport. I went through on down to where the waiting room was, and I saw this Japanese man with this little 2 or 3 year old child on his shoulder, patting him. I knew then that that was my man. We didn't have an interpreter at that time, but we understood each other, you know. He knew that I all about, they had, They invited me to stay for a week at their expense. Hotel, transportation, wherever, whatever we did. I only paid for my airfare. And they took me to the hotel, which was a international hotel where foreigners did stay, and many of them did speak English. And the next morning he met me. No, that night we had a tremendous welcome party. There were three or four veterans and their wives. There was the premier, the political leader of the Solomon Islands. I'll tell you, it was absolutely, I was astounded, you know. Mm. And they had a beautiful dinner and an interpreter. He was with us, Mr. Kikimoto and I, for the entire week. Mm. Wherever we went, the interpreter was there with us. Mm. But that evening banquet, it was just like a family dinner. And a welcome dinner. They were just honoring me, you know, for coming. And then they explained that I would meet with the Veterans Association the next morning. We walked a couple of blocks. This was a huge shrine. It involved any number of buildings. But the one that we went into was the main temple area. And I walked in, I didn't know what to expect. I walked into that, we would call it a worship area, with Susumu Kikimoto. And there were 50 Japanese veterans sitting on the floor. And they also have family members that have lost family men in the battles of World War II. And I was interested in the Shinto ceremony. And to show you how detailed they were, rather than my standing up or sitting down, they had a stool for me to sit on. And then the interpreter said to me, you may participate in this Shinto ceremony. He briefly, it wasn't complicated, he explained the procedure. And I went to that table. There were five Japanese veterans to my right, and they were sounding this gong. The priest came forward and handed me a bough off of an evergreen tree of some type. Well, I was supposed to take it and then reverse it and put the butt back to him. And he gave that to each of the veterans that were there. They went through the same procedure. And I said, Lord, I don't believe this, but I'm worshiping you. You are the vine and I am the bough. I'm the branch. You're the vine. That made it personal with him, you see.
Yeah.
The next thing we did was bow slowly three times. And I've got great peripheral vision. I could see them, you know. And I was right with them. That bowing was to honor them, honor their gods, you know. The next thing they did was clap three times in unison. And then step back. That completed the ceremony. But the clapping was to get attention of the god, you see. It was all very, very, very nice, you know. And I respected what they were doing, and I just let my Lord know what I was doing. Well, we sat down, and then we went out into the auditorium, the major meeting area. And there was a head table of four or five men. Everyone was in the black. They wear black. All the veterans were wearing black. And there were some ladies there and some young men there. This is an exact copy of the flag. Kinko did this for me. I took it, took the flag to them. And there was a young man in there that I had become friends with. I've been taking in so many things to copy, you know. But he folded it in quarters and printed it. And then he worked with it, each quarter. And it's put to, put together. You don't even realize that it's four different sections.
Until you turn it over.
But it is, though.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, look at this. It has, look at the way it's, see how exact that is?
Mm-hmm.
It's all colored. And I knocked something down.
Didn't it? Yeah, it released.
But my friend, the waitress, had translated the names for me. There were five names on here. And she said that the owner was a very important person. And how she knew that, I don't know, unless it was the wishes that they had put on there for him. But there was a, I have written down, she wrote down for me the meaning, you know, all the names, and the good wishes, good success in battle. But she did say that he was, she called him a high class person. When I went into the room, the auditorium, would you excuse me just a moment? And officially, it wasn't made to General Shepherd. It was made to the Chinese general who was the commander of that northern area since the Japan had attacked them, you know. But we were certainly a part of it. I have pictures of the parades that we had through town. And we would have our pieces hooked up to our trucks. And the infantry would be there. And we would parade through Qingdao, through the streets. It was a display of power against the communists, you see. As much as it was, because the Japanese had already been defeated. But the Japanese, they were behind a kind of a barbed wire, big wire fence, a barrier. And they were three or four deep. And they were, you know how the Japanese are, they are impassive. No expression. Nothing. Even on the street. No expression. They never look anyone in the eye. If you look a Japanese in the eye, you're offending him.
Hmm.
And that really, when I was walking and nobody would even look at me, I thought.
Interesting.
But I have a lot of pictures of more of our China trip.
Was there anything you'd like to finish with?
Yes, let's finish with this. Why don't I sit over here by your side?
Okay.
Then I can. This is the my meeting with the Japanese at the Shinto Center. This is at Susumu Kikimoto. He was in the Navy at Bougainville. Let me pick that up, would you please?
Yeah.
I know we're taking a lot of time. We're going to finish up with this.
Okay.
Because this is vitally important. That's me. This man's name is Yabuki. He was an infantry captain on Guadalcanal. This gentleman was the prime minister of the islands. Look at that bouquet. They said, you are a very important person, and they put that thing on me. The translator, and the other one is the secretary. He would be the national secretary of our, like we have at labor or human relations. And he was there because the veteran affairs come under his.
Mm.
Now, when I walked in, here, this is the speaker's podium, and they had the flag draped over it. This was right after the dinner. These are the veterans, 50 of them. And they asked me to give the history of this flag. I gave the history of island by island, just as I have my written down there. And this is, I'm talking, this is the flag. This is the Japanese national flag. And this, I think, is the Navy captain that was talking also at that time. Then they had entertainers, and these are different officials. It was absolutely a quality meeting. It was something that you might encounter at our presidential meeting.
Hmm.
And look at this. This is me. This is the Kikamoto, and that's I believe that's the Secretary of Labor and Human Relations. Here we are. After dinner, after lunch, then we have chat time, just as you would with a Rotary Club, you know. Here I am. We finished our dinner. People are coming and talking with me. No, absolutely no tension whatsoever. Nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Remarkable. This young man, I was talking with him. He was the president of a bearing company in Japan. And I said, do you know about our Timken roller bearing company? Oh, yes, he said. We do business with Timken. And then very quietly said, my father starved to death on Bougainville.
Mm.
Hmm? No prompting, nothing, you know.
Mm.
But after we had secured our part, you know, we didn't take the whole island, but our Navy kept it surrounded and prevented any supplies or anything coming. So they starved to death, you see.
Mm.
Yeah, his father starved to death. Let's see, let's talk about, this is the premier of the Solomon Islands. And I call him Susumu Kikamoto. He was my principal host. He goes back to Guadalcanal and Guam every year seeking for the bones of those that they have not recovered, because they show their respect for that individual by returning his bones to the, and he then becomes a deity in the. And I said to him, to Susumu Kikamoto, I said to him, I have the history of a Guadalcanal battle and also a Bougainville. I probably have some maps in there of battles that were fought that you don't even know about. I said, when I get back home, I'll print those and send them to you. I said, I'll help you locate the bones of your men. And I did. Couple of other stories that might be interesting. They stood and honored me after I finished the talk.
Mm-hmm.
Stood, attention, and I saluted them. See that right there?
Mm-hmm.
You honor me, I'm going to honor you. I'm going to respond correctly too, you know. Hmm? Now, here we are. This is Yabuki. Before I made my trip, I had a call from a Delta Airlines pilot in Louisville. He had a Marine friend that lived in Georgia that was on Guadalcanal. And his friend had picked up a Japanese sketchbook. This Japanese soldier had sketched individuals that were in his infantry company. And the Marine wanted his friend, the Delta Flyer, to take the book to Japan and try to return it to the people, you know. But he didn't want to go himself. The pilot took it and located some of these people and returned that sketchbook to him. One of the sketches, Mr. Yabuki handed me his sketch. His sketch was in the book that had been returned by the other Marine. What about that?
Yeah, that's amazing.
I'll tell you, there's a lot of Marines doing things now that isn't known, you know. I mean, there are many a meeting to celebrate the memorial services. They go to each other's memorial service. Hmm. So he showed me the book. I have here several newspaper items that were published in Japan while I was there. Now this is closely related to that to Bougainville. Most of these individuals, they thought were probably from one province. And there was one man who had planned to come to the reunion that had fought on Bougainville, infantryman. But he was ill and couldn't come. But his story was in the Japanese paper, along with the reason for my coming. His story was that he was wounded. And after the battle, when the others withdrew, he was ready to commit suicide. He had it to his chest. When a friend came back looking for survivors, and the friend persuaded him not to kill himself. And he said, I'm thankful that that did. But there's another relation to Bougainville. Very close. I could have walked right by that man. He said, on the seventh day, the Marines overwhelmed us. We lost 3,000 men. This is his story. 3,000. I remember the day. I understood that we learned. This was early in the campaign, at the tail end of the first week, that they were going to occupy the next morning the same area that we planned to move into. We just didn't move in. But we oriented every gun we had on the island on that area. The next morning around 9 o'clock, we knew that they were in there. Our gunners were given permission to fire at will. Fire as fast as you can. Every gun on the island. Fast as they could load it and pull that lanyard, you know. We went in behind it. I'll tell you, you couldn't imagine. I couldn't describe what it was like. It was the most gory thing that I would ever see. It was something out of hell, you know. Body parts blown apart. Coconut trees dismantled. People blown all apart and all laying in different directions. Terrible thing, you know. But, you know, it's war, you see. Mm-hmm. It happens to everybody. Not everybody, but many. And when I walked through that thing, I'll tell you one thing. I was glad when I got through it. I didn't want to see it again. And here I am going to meet with the Guadalcanal's veteran. And here's this guy who experienced that, you see.
Yeah.
What about that? And he says, he's thankful that his friend talked him out of killing himself. Let's see, what else? One other story there. His picture isn't in here, but I remember him specifically because he was very... This is Kikimoto and I. This was taken for a newspaper story. This is a picture taken in a Buddha. They're not supposed to take pictures, but they took one. Here's the man I'm talking about, right here. He was taller than other, you can see he's taller.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to talk to me. And we were talking about Guadalcanal and Bougainville, and I said to him, what did you do? He listened on the radio, see? He wrote out, and the translator said, he listened to transmissions between American ships. And then he wrote a word. The translator pronounced it. He said, this is the word that they knew was Pearl Harbor. Whenever they heard this, they knew it was Pearl Harbor was involved. This big guy smilingly said to me, tell me, is this still the same name for Pearl Harbor? And smiled. I said, I'm not sure. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm not going to find out. Because the CIA would certainly throw me in jail if I did. He really laughed about that. This is an example, you know, of the... This is a golden temple here. There are just so many beautiful things that I can show you. Let's look in here. Two or three others about fun time, if I can find them. Let's look in here. By the way, this other flag,
mm-hmm.
There was a man and his wife contacted me and had read the story in the Louisville paper about my carrying the flag. There were three or four stories, my going over and coming back. And I said, yes, I'm the man. And he said, we want you to return the flag for us. That's his son's flag.
Hmm.
Huh? What about that? This one has a lot of names on it. 40 or more. I took this flag to the Indiana University over in southern Indiana. The Japanese lady translated that for me. Remember that young Rotarian?
Mm-hmm.
His father lives near Cleveland, Ohio. And I had talked with him a couple of times. And he goes to visit with his son. Of course, his son's father-in-law is Susumu Kikimoto. I said, I have a flag, another Japanese flag, that a couple wants to send back to the veterans. He said, I'll be glad to take it. Imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
He took the flag. Now look at this. Here's this flag. This is in Susumu Kikimoto's home. He and his wife got this flag on them. And these are vitally important materials to the Japanese. But now they've got two flags, you see.
Hmm? Mm-hmm.
Something, isn't it? I'm going to do something else. I'm going to send all those pictures. I didn't show all those to you. Of the Japanese infantrymen and tankers on Guam. Though I got the originals. I'm going to send those back to them. And I'm going to include the Marine pictures with them, you know. Let them know that the Japanese soldier had our pictures. That's for their historical
mm-hmm.
record.
Yeah.
Hmm? But I haven't given any of this to our...
Okay.
This is my farewell party. Tremendous farewell party. Everybody brings gifts. These are beautiful ladies. Look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here's my friends. This is the big guy that listens.
Yeah.
This is the student. That's Mr. and Mrs. Kikimoto. And this is the premier there. These are friends of the family. Now, as Christmas approached, I contacted the Delta airline pilot. I said, I'm going to send some Christmas gifts to Susumu Kikimoto. And this, would you take them, the pilot? He said, I said, I'll arrange with them for to meet you. These are all the gifts that I sent to them. He flew them over, went to the hotel where they were waiting for him. That's Kikimoto's wife. That's his daughter. That's the little boy. That's the daughter there. This is the airline pilot with Kikimoto. Wherever we went, we attracted attention. We were going through a big ancient castle. And these school kids came up. You know, they all wear the, and they were chattering like teenage kids will. And they came, they looked at me and wondered, what am I doing here? So they talked to Kikimoto. And Kikimoto said, they want to talk to you because they study English in high school and they never get to talk with an American. I had some wonderful times. So we had a wonderful talk with these. They knew enough that we could communicate, you know.
Yeah.
One of them said, do you like raw fish? Oh, I said, yes, I do, but I want a hamburger today. We just had a lot of fun together.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they said, where do you live? I said, Kentucky. They said, Kentucky, where's Kentucky, you know? Oh, we had a good time there. Kikimoto and I having a little break. I've got one I want to show you about, if I can find it. Oh, I went to the Rotary Club one Thursday. This is at the Rotary Club, Kyoto Kanda Japan Rotary Club. I'm a Rotarian, International Fellowship, there we are. At one hotel one morning, I heard the English people, men talking in a meeting. Went back and introduced myself. Here's some businessmen from Atlanta, and they've been invited to Tokyo for a meeting on their business. And they said, I said, my son works in Atlanta. He works for Bell South. What's his name? This guy said, oh, I said, I've talked with your son in our business. You know? This is one of the schools that I attended. This little lady, you know, I mentioned to you that we had stopped in New Zealand. This is 60 years later. I'm interested in the school, and they bring her down as our host to show us through the school. And she's from Auckland, New Zealand. Her father has a sheep station there. Oh, here's a funny one here. We were having a dinner, and this guy was, we were talking about the wrestling, and he is an athlete. So we got talking. And we have to have a little arm wrestling, you see. But before he would go home, he left the restaurant twice. And each time he brought me a beautiful series of large pictures of the wrestlers. And went out and got another one of scenery. This is Kikimoto and I having a nice beer after the meeting. You're getting weary of this, I know that. And I
well, we
too.
Need to wrap up.
I know we do.
We need to wrap up.
So, I'm overwhelming you, aren't I?
Well,